Hello, hello, my lovelies. This is Judy McCord. Welcome out to Out on the Edge, where each week co-hosts Judy, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu celebrate the rich diversity of our 55-plus LGBTQ-plus community, our queer elders, who we are, where we came from, and what we continue to bring to the party in these interesting times. Today, January 12th, in this new year, 2026, our guest is the person most near and dear to me, my partner, lover, soulmate, husband, my inspiration for 40 years, Mac McCord. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM for hosting our show. Out on the Edge is brought to you by the LGBTQ Plus Senior Resource Team of the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We're deeply grateful for their guidance and support. We acknowledge and honor that the town of Carborough and surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi People's Territory, which also included the Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori Nation. Please join us each week as we interview special guests to share stories for, by, and about our elders in the LGBTQ plus community. You can hear the show on the air Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, or stream us live on WCOMFM.org. Robin and Mac, on with the show.
Hello, hello, hello. Yes, it has been since last year that I was here. How are you doing, Mac?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Good. It's a new year. But we wanted to have Mac back. Mac back. Oh, look at that. That
sounds Mac like- back.
That sounds like a line of, you know, husky clothing for foul weather gear or something.
Mac back.
Yes.
Your Mac back.
Good. When you were here before, we talked quite a bit about who you are, how you emerged as Mac, your transition, and everything like that. And I was hoping that we were hoping today we could go a little bit more specifically on your creative outlets. I mean, I've known you 2010. At my first puppetry convention. And a little known fact for our listeners, it took 3 years before you told me you were trans, before I realized you were trans, which obviously my trans daughter is just fakakta. So just like, oh boy, that. So, but that's a really easy way to slide into. I knew you first as a puppeteer. Then we both were as part of the New York Theater Workshop playwriting cohort in 2022. And we have done, you and Judy and I have all done Sips and Scripts, the playwriting lab, for years, and that sort of thing. And you and I have, and well, again, Judy and you and I have all been working on your Light at the Edge, a giant, huge, monolithic, terrible tale of awful, terrible things that were done in Ireland, but we're doing it with puppets and music and stuff like that. And so it's all, which is to say, I have been hearing your work as a composer as well. Mm-hmm. So as a puppeteer, as a playwright, I've read your poetry, and as a musician, those are all these things. So I wanted us to just talk about and jump in anytime, everybody else. Just how has the overall theme is, how has this diversity of creativity, all these different mediums, how have they helped with your transition? How have they hindered your transition, if at all? And how do all these different ways of expressing yourself help you with that? And you can start with some specific things, like when you were when you were 3 or 4 years old, what happened?
Well, one of my first memories is actually I used to stand on a stool and conduct to the classical records we had. And I think I was about 3 or 4. I was old enough to stand on the stool and not fall off. And my mother used to get mad because she'd have me all ready for bed in my pajamas, and I'd conduct and get sweaty, and she then, you know,
Well, she had it okay. I was the same way with Sousa marches, and I was reading parades around the house. So at least you were in one place.
Yeah. I had a connection to music, you know, right away. And when I was a little kid, it didn't matter. You know, it didn't matter what you did. You were a little kid, you know. And I self-identified as a boy, even though, you know, I kept being told I wasn't, obviously. And, but I don't know, in those days, being a tomboy was okay.
Yeah.
Up until a certain age. You know? You were cool. Yeah. So I climbed trees and, you know, did what I wanted to do.
So you had a chance to sort of explore writing and music and stuff like that, and nobody thought that it was a mask or something you were hiding?
No. If they did, they didn't say anything to it to me. My father was absent most of the time because he went to sea. He was in the Merchant Marine. But he was also a musician. He was a really skilled guitarist, played by ear, had played on the Grand Ole Opry. So as a young kid, I'd pick out things on the guitar or the piano. Never learned to read music, never even... I didn't have the... Back then, I guess I didn't have the patience to sit still long enough to learn how to read music. You know, I was running around the neighborhood, climbing trees. And one thing that helped that was I started riding, riding lessons at six.
So, riding, yeah, horses?
Horses, yeah. Okay. And I think that, well, it was one way to keep me focused.
Yeah.
Because you have to focus on a horse. You can't not focus, or you're not going to be there long. But there was a connection with the horses because they're very super sensitive animals.
Yeah.
And they take care of you most of the time unless they've been really abused or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so anyway, that was kind of a lifeline, and it didn't matter what gender you were.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, for a long, long time, people used to, I think the Olympics... All of the Olympic things were gendered except riding. That was the one big, you know, international thing. It didn't matter who was on the horse, you know.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. So women could ride just as well as men, sometimes a lot better, because a lot of times women don't try to force the animal to do something it doesn't want to do. Horses pick up on that and go, okay. Not always, but, you know. Lost my train of thought. But anyway, I had those outlets growing up.
Okay. At a very young age, because you were... when did dogs come in? You mentioned it when...
Well, we always had dogs.
Always had dogs. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
We had a couple of Cocker Spaniels, and when we moved, I know my parents dumped them in the pound, but they didn't tell me that. So... But I... with one of those Cockers, I raised my first litter of puppies when I was about eight.
Okay.
Right. We got one out of the shelter and brought her home, and 3 days later, she had puppies. So I raised these puppies, and we got their tails docked, and we found them homes, and mm-hmm. Dogs were just always there.
You've been doing all of this, so you were able to tap into a variety, writing, music, animal communication, if you will. But you know, I mean, you had outlets. Where you could express yourself in non-verbal ways, and in a part of the country and in a family situation where you're being more than a tomboy was just not something that you could really had the freedom to discuss. So.
You know, my early years were in Middle Tennessee back in the 50s, and then in the 60s we moved out to California, which was Northern California, which was great. But still, you know, my parents were fairly conservative. not anything like what's happening now.
No.
Not even close, but still. But go.
I'm going to say I'm curious to go. I honestly go back to the music for it, because it sounds like you're one of these people for whom music came easily, and I can understand, not just easily, but automatically. I mean, you could hear. You're one of these people who can hear and copy and do that. And I think that also makes you impatient with formal study.
Yes.
But because you can just do it. Why
I can do it, so why should
study?
I sit there and learn what that little dot means?
So, but at some point, you've become such a professional, from my perspective, in your musicality, that how did you get from that little kid to finally... Oh yeah, study is might benefit me, or I, you know.
Well,
what's
I didn't
that journey.
I didn't pursue music.
It pursued
if there
you.
Was a piano, I'd sit down and make up stuff, or I'd play on a guitar and make up stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't write it down because I didn't know how to. But I was doing all this other stuff as a kid. You know, horses and dogs. Oh. I got a Chihuahua when I was 10. And he lived to be 19.
Wow.
And typical Chihuahua, mean as a snake. I mean, I love Chihuahuas, and they really shouldn't be mean, but he was spicy. But he taught me a lot about dog behavior, because you cannot make a Chihuahua do something it doesn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they will literally hold their breath and pass out. So it's you have to learn how to negotiate. It's a transactional thing.
That what a warning for potential Chihuahua owners. Boy, I had no idea. I had no idea they were that ornery. Okay.
Well,
it's like Jedi training.
Jedi training. And you know, when you weigh 4 to 8 pounds, you gotta do something.
Yeah.
You gotta have a big something going on, or you're not gonna survive very long.
It's called nonviolent protest. Just hold your
But that dog, he lived to be 19, and he taught me a whole lot about dog behavior, about how to work with difficult dogs, which, you know, led me later into getting into dogs professionally. But, he was my buddy, and he actually kept me from getting, I don't know if I would say molested one time, but the town drunk, I was still in Tennessee walking my dog down the street, and the town drunk came and grabbed me by the shoulder and kind of turned me around to face him, and Chico just swung around and landed right in his nuts. I mean, he went for it.
My God.
Scared the guy. He was drunk anyway. He was not expecting this flying thing with teeth.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I was like,
go Chico. What a great dog.
Yeah, he was a great dog, you know. And, you know, I later took him through obedience and learned how to actually train dogs and showed him in obedience. So we had a long thing, but he kind of helped me learn about dogs.
So he was your tutor in that?
Yeah, he was my tutor. And I would say to someone who wants a Chihuahua, they will test you, you know, kind of like a cat. There are certain things you cannot make a cat do if it doesn't want to
do it. Like most things, right?
Like most things.
Most things, yeah.
But you can negotiate.
I can't imagine better training for an audience of children at a puppet show than what you just described having gone through with Chico. That if you can handle Chico, you can handle a bunch of 4 and 5 and 6 year olds.
It's funny you said that. I was always...
That's the lights.
The lights went off.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I never liked being around young children at all.
Me either.
Never.
It's,
never, ever.
It's a trans
I'd see
thing
a group of kids and I would turn and go the other way.
It's no, like, it's not. No. Not just a trans thing.
No.
Maybe it's a gay thing.
I'm kidding. We
I don't think it's a gay thing either.
I shouldn't add to it, but yes, I love children.
Yeah, it just... when I was behind the scrim, that's different because you're sort of protected.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about specifically.
Because, you know, and a lot of puppeteers like Sherry
Lewis.
Lewis, God. I know her daughter. It's like, damn.
Yeah.
She's out front with
right. put the hands up.
A lot of people, I was like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
But that was a good way for me to kind of find more of my creativity and, first of all, tell stories. The puppets mm-hmm. told stories.
Right.
And I would just put them on and let them rip. You know, I didn't write things down ahead of time. I had puppets who were certain characters, and I'd put them on, and they would do whatever they would do.
It's incomprehensible to me. I wrote a piece of music when I was 8.
Yeah.
I had no idea what I was doing. I did it because, that note looks good on that line, and that looks...
that's a good way to do it.
I wrote it out the way it looked. I have no idea ever how it sounded, but I wrote my first piece of music. When I was taking theory in college, I started fiddling with 12-tone row stuff mm-hmm. with, assigning letters to note values and stuff like that, and then writing sentences and taking that sequence of notes mm-hmm. and turning it into melody and harmonizing.
Yeah.
And my teacher thought I was brilliant.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, my God, Stravinsky, get out of the way, buddy. I'm coming for you. But I was so analytical about that. I cannot do improv at all. I freeze with that. So you're...
That's what it sounds like, improv.
Yeah. If you could say, create a framework for a puppet and say, here, and then the puppet do its stuff, I can't do that. I have to have a script.
Well, the one thing that I learned very quickly about doing live shows
mm-hmm.
with kids, and that's what you're mostly expected to do, unless you're lucky enough to work in TV or something, is that they're kind of like dogs. You know, they're very bright. They're very social. Sometimes they're very loud. Sometimes they'll try to bite you or whatever.
You're talking about the kids, right?
Yeah.
Are the dogs or the kids?
The kids.
Yeah, the kids.
Dogs
in other words, it's an intimidating audience, but at the same time, if you just go in and the puppets start talking to them, they will immediately come back with stuff, and you just go with it. You know, because
definitely,
and if you don't like what they're saying, you just talk over them and keep going. You know, talk over is not the right phrase.
But there are times you just need to get the attention.
We keep going.
There's another trick Mac used to do. The Aloysius, the MC of the
Tiger,
Mm-hmm. He would, if the kids were getting rambunctious, he would keep talking but whispering.
Yeah.
So the kids,
the quieter you get, the quieter they get.
See, the puppet was making sounds, but they couldn't hear the puppet.
And there's always some little girl in the front row saying, "Y'all shut up! I want to hear this."
That works beautifully.
I like that.
Yeah. It does work. Can you still hear me if I'm back here?
I think yes.
You should be okay. It's a little. It's hard to tell here in the studio. The tech things is. You should be fine because the software takes care of that. And what we're trying to gauge is what's in our headphones, which is not the same thing as the signal that's going out. So it's deceptive.
And see, that just divides my mind right. So I don't think about that.
Back
on track.
Yeah.
But
it's funny you were talking about how you started writing music. Actually, if you look at a staff paper
mm-hmm.
and you put your notes in the blank plate, not on the lines,
right,
and go up and down, it will be very harmonious.
I see, yes.
Same thing for the lines, because that's putting you into a different...
Whole steps, basically.
Exactly, because you're following the half-step, whole-step thing, pretty much.
Right.
Assuming you're using Western notation.
Correct.
I went to... I was at the flute fair. When was it? November, I think. It was a big flute fair, and I went, and there was a lady who was teaching carnatic flute playing, which is in South Indian.
Oh, okay.
India.
Right, with the Demi-Hemi Sebi
quivers. Yeah, they have a very different scale and everything. Mm-hmm. But once you learn that scale, you can just go in that.
Yeah.
But it messes with your brain because we don't do the hemi-demis quite as much.
No.
Is that a real word, or did you just make that up?
I kind of made it up. But
semi-quaver, semi-quaver, semi-demi-heavy quaver, all of those things.
Actually, if you read any English, British descriptions of music. They call their notes, but they do use quavers and all of that, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
But that's what they're called,
mm-hmm.
you know, traditionally. And, of course, we came over here and changed it, which is fine. But anyway, that was an aside.
Part of it is because you said that you were able to perform. You could not perform out front like Sherry Lewis.
I was not behind that.
How much of that was just Mac, and how much freedom did that give you as part of your transition? If I'm remembering right, you puppeteered early, and then you took it a while, and then you came back to it after you transitioned. How was it different?
But when I first started doing puppetry, I was still a kid myself, basically.
Right.
So I didn't think about trans. Right. I didn't even know the word. You know, I knew I was not a regular girl.
Yeah.
And that led to a lot of complications later. But transition was not ever on the horizon even at that point. So I think when I was doing puppets first, it was just a matter of survival, you know. I needed to make money, and I'd put the puppets in the bag and go do a show and get paid, and it's like, this is cool.
Okay.
You know, and had a good time. If I'm not having a good time, nobody, you know. You have to kind of go with the flow of your audience, and all the audiences are different.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get past 2 and 3 year olds, kids are very creative, and they'll do the show for you, basically. You just kind of go with it.
Nice.
You know.
Nice.
But,
so.
So I didn't even think about that.
Right.
But
it wasn't
when I got back into puppetry.
Yeah.
And when was that?
It was after we had moved to Lewisburg, which was post-transition.
Yeah. So it would have been in the... Well, I met you in 2010.
Yeah.
I was already
re-upping
the puppet
stage. That's why your notes previous show said
but,
you had a gap.
You know,
I was like, what?
But at that point, I wasn't thinking trans or not.
You were just doing the show.
I was just doing shows. I was just me.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay.
I adopted the name Mac. And actually, when I was a little kid, when my parents were around, I asked people to call me Mac. I couldn't do that when they were around because my mother would freak. So, you know. But it just seemed a logical thing to do at the time. But anyway, but very, very shortly thereafter, you know, the trans thing came up. And I was like, oh, this is why I really like being inside the puppet stage with the curtains closed and, you know, nobody's bothering me. I didn't feel like I was on display, that I had to perform.
Your art could be on display, and they weren't judging it by the messenger.
And I think a lot of puppeteers, I worked for Tom Titchener for a number of years at the National Library,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge mm-hmm. library, had a huge children's department, and he was a puppeteer early on, I mean from the 40s on, and he was painfully shy.
Oh,
painfully shy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think a lot of people who do go into puppets do it because we're hiding ourselves.
Right. That's one of the things I was hoping we could touch on was the puppet as mask.
Puppets and masks are basically the same.
I mean the puppet itself as a mask for the performer,
right.
rather than not so much a physical mask. But I mean, but that's.
But if you put on a mask, you know, or go in and you become something different.
Right. I find that they're very freeing.
Yeah, it's very freeing.
I'm just a hypothetical. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or anything like that. Well, at least not at the moment.
Not yet.
But I would say a good way to illustrate what I'm fumbling around with is that let's say Aloysius would say things that Mac could never say.
Oh yeah, all the time.
And so that's kind of what I'm looking at is the puppet. You know, it's a freedom thing.
It is a freedom thing.
I mean,
and I had puppet villains. They weren't really mean, but you know, I had like this fox who was kind of scary with the teeth. They were all really stupid, but you know,
the best kind of villain.
That was the fun part about them, because you could really get mean, but you're not really being mean,
right?
Because it's, you know, and kids understand that, and they love the villains.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a good villain, you got no show.
Yeah.
I mean, really. It's...
Because the villain has to meet his or her comeuppance at some point. Is that
part of it? At some point, sometimes they decide to come over for dinner or what. You know, it just depends. But, yeah, you do need a good villain. And I think that's true of any kind of theatrical, even a story. You have to have the antagonist, because the antagonist drives everything else.
Yeah, the protagonist would do nothing if there wasn't something to react.
If it was all happy bunnies playing in a field, well, nothing's going to happen unless somebody, a fox, comes along and tries to eat one of the bunnies.
Bambi meets Godzilla, one of the best stories ever.
Oh, yeah, I love Godzilla.
Bambi meets Godzilla.
So. I loved monster movies when I was a kid and all of that. I just, you know, ate them. And I think being an only child, too, led me more to, you know, doing the puppets and things.
So
in what way?
Well, I didn't really have a lot of people to play with. And as I got older, when I was little, I'd play with the neighborhood boys. You know, climb trees, wrestle, beat each other up, you know, all the fun kind of things you do. And I was never particularly... I didn't dislike girls, but I didn't want to play with them because I thought they were boring. You know. And, you know, that gradually started to change as I got older, but there was a point to that. Rambling, sorry if I start.
No, that's
but
not.
I think when you're
and you felt alone too.
You felt alone.
Yeah, when
Buffett
you feel alone,
friends.
You're you become more careful. You know, which is I think why I had the puppets, because I could hide beneath. And if people thought I was weird, well, they're a puppeteer. What do you expect?
They're the same.
And most puppeteers I've met have been very weird. I mean, Jim Henson on a good day was, you did not talk to Jim, you had to talk to Kermit. The next day you'd talk to him just like a normal person. So,
Of the strangest things I've seen have been puppeteer cabaret with free forms. I mean, the stuff that you and I saw at conventions, and then other ones that I have seen where puppeteers just come in like late at night and everybody's drunk and everybody's just open for anything.
Free for all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the first puppet shows I ever got involved with, and right after college, all of a sudden it became X-rated in our rehearsals.
Oh, yeah. It get X-rated really fast.
And so it stopped because we couldn't put that on stage for the kids, so we saved it and did it for ourselves at the end of the season when we had our big closing night party.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very dirty.
Potpourri. Mm. Puppet potpourris.
Can I interrupt you before you get too X-rated?
Huh?
We'd
like
to do a station identification or maybe
already?
A message from our sponsors. Take a minute and have a breath, all right, guys? I just love having you here, Mac. I have to tell you that. It's just
fabulous. Good, since we're married. really
this
awkward
is,
if we weren't.
This is a new way to share my life with you
okay.
and vice versa. I love it. So, let's see. We are sponsored by the Orange County Department on Aging, and we are members of the LGBTQ+ Senior Resource Team. By we, I mean your fine hosts for this show. And the Department on Aging has a goal and a mission to provide a safe and affirming space for all of their clients, all of their people. And they created this senior resource team for that purpose. And the space that we provide for the gay elders in Orange County includes all sorts of things, not just being creative, not just being on the road, I mean on the radio. We also have an LGBTQ plus death cafe, and this is a international concept, the death cafe. We decided we were going to have one for our LGBTQ plus community, and it's amazing. It's actually a place that gives us a safe place to discuss difficult topics, the questions you didn't know you wanted to ask, to find self-awareness and to develop compassionate connections and identify resources for end-of-life choices and considerations and help. So that's what happens at an LGBTQ plus death cafe. We have one every month on the fourth Thursday of the month, which happens to be next week. It starts at 2 o'clock, and it goes to 3:30. It's at the Seymour Center on Homestead Road in Chapel Hill. It's free, and to register, please call the Seymour Center front desk at 919-968-2070. You might be actually treated to some cookies. It is a cafe, you see. So do come and check us out. It's a, as I say, it's a safe place. It's a confidential space where you're not going to be worried about anybody telling your story outside of the death cafe.
Plus cookies.
And cookies. Yeah.
And
yeah,
what's the date and time again?
The date is Thursday, January 22nd, 2 o'clock to 3:30. So back to you, Mac and Robin.
Okay. Well, not to get all existential and everything, but I think one of the things that prompted me to ask about the puppet as mask is part of how much masking trans people do instinctively and consciously and in a very self-defensive way in many cases, hiding from people. And so it sounds like you have so many outlets to express yourself safely that no one would look, as you said, no one would look at a puppet and wonder about the gender identity of the puppeteer, unless you said, "Hi, I'm a trans person," and I have a trans person with his arm up, and or the music is it. But my, how has your diversity of your mastery of so many different mediums, how has that allowed you to be continually expressive? Like if you get stumped for a rhyme for a poem, to be really silly, like can you turn around and start writing some more music, or you come up with an idea for a script? I mean, having so many outlets has given you a variety of ways to express yourself and be as much of a self discovery of your own inner dialogue with yourself as it is communicating your soul to the audience. That got really esoteric there, but I think I hope that's clear.
Well, I think part of the reasons I got into so many different things is because, like I said, I had no patience.
Right. No. And yeah, polymath is the word that I have seen.
Well,
that is really
maybe
wonderful.
I don't know,
word.
But
yes, no, you are. You're definitely,
but not math.
No,
definitely
don't mention
not
math. I don't do math.
No, that's just the word.
Math's a,
but
no.
Anyway.
The music, again, I got from my father, but then when I did get into music, I was a sophomore in high school when I actually took up the flute and learned how to read music and went, oh, man, I can play Beethoven and all this cool stuff, and went hot and heavy in that. And the only reason I didn't pursue it, now this was back in the 60s, to go to school as a music major, was because back then, girls had to wear skirts to play in the orchestra or band.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, no.
So, which is kind of stupid, because I'd probably gotten a lot better faster. But even then, when I joined the Army as a flute player, I was still female. I was certainly not... Didn't mention you couldn't even be gay at that time, but duh. If all the gay troops left, you would not have much left.
That's a whole other show.
That's another show. But the Army gave kind of a masking and structure. Because people aren't just going to come up.
Right.
When you're in uniform with your unit, they're not going to... Yeah.
The point is to disappear into the group.
Absolutely,
no individuality.
And I really didn't have any trouble.
Sure, yeah. You know, no, I get it, yeah.
With anybody. You know, in a way, I think I had a very, I wouldn't say easy, but mm-hmm. After a while, you kind of develop a sixth sense of who's safe and
yeah.
who isn't.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. My wife and I had a very similar conversation about how I did these things instinctively as a kid growing up, going into music so I didn't have to take PE. Things like that. And I didn't know why.
At that point. And like I said, and then to make money, because going into music, unless you're just really, really lucky, you're not going to make much money.
Right, yeah.
I did teach and stuff like that, but that's, again, so I got back into dogs. I got into dogs professionally in the 70s, and I apprenticed under some major professional handlers, and... for those who don't know, a professional handler is somebody who runs around in a circle to the left and makes the dog stand there and gets a ribbon.
I saw that movie. What was the best in show?
Yeah, it's it is a profession, and I did that.
That's,
but what was important was the dog, not me.
Absolutely. No, that's a way to do it. But I'm not sure where are we with time. Okay, because I wanted to make sure we covered was your writing.
Yeah.
Because a little co-host told me that she gets a poem from you every birthday or Christmas or something like that, and tell it. Using your poetry to talk to your partner, everything like that. How is that part of Mac? And that's again variety of expression. You have so many of them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like you have any preferred way of communication, but that's a particularly
nice
one. I wanted you to hear. I wanted the audience to know about.
Yeah. I started writing as a little kid, but didn't really start writing until computers came along and I learned how to type.
Yeah. And you said you published a lot of stuff too? And
I published a lot of stuff. I published a lot of stuff, particularly in the 90s in zines. Remember the zine craze?
Yeah.
I wrote a lot of erotic horror. I wrote all kinds of stuff. Poems.
Oh, there's a few more shows than all this. I can hear
Yes,
keep going.
Well, you know.
We'll do a late night show where we can use swear words,
scary.
Too. I'm sure Orange County won't mind.
No, they won't mind. And I got a lot published. Once in a while, I'd get, back then, you'd maybe get $10 or something.
Wow.
I remember once getting $30 to a dog magazine,
And you married someone who just got a poem accepted by the town of Chapel Hill as well, too. Congratulations,
Poetry,
Judy.
To me, is kind of the epitome of writing because you have to distill everything.
Right. And there's so much musicality in it as
There's music, which, and of course, I was lucky enough to go to high school and college in Northern California, not Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare was big, I went to a lot of the Shakespeare things. I love the language.
Right.
I think poetry is a way to say things you can't say any other way.
Right.
And then to me, music is a way to say things when you don't have words.
Exactly.
When you have run out of words or the words are not coming, then music carries whatever that is.
Exactly.
Further.
And that's again, that's the point of my this particular interview is how that flexibility of communication when you can't say it in one way, you have a way of, you, Mac, have a way of saying it in another.
Right.
And that's just, I mean, it's one of the reasons that I admire you so much.
It's probably the reason I'm still alive.
There you go. See, and one of the things that you haven't done that I have seen in so many other people who have the drive to express themselves but can't, they don't know how to do that. They don't know. You've learned how to channel your expression ability to your expressive side through creative outlets. The like I said, the animal care, the writing, the music, the poetry, the playwriting. That a lot of people turn to self medication because they don't know how anything else like that. And
well,
I am so glad as a person that you never did that because. I value our friendship. No, I value our friendship, and I'm basically saying I'm really glad you're a survivor.
Yeah. Actually,
so am I.
The dogs and horses kept me going.
Yeah.
Now and as far as using other substances and stuff, when you're a professional dog handler, you have to be very careful because there are some dogs that will take one sniff of you and take you down if you're on something.
Oh, yeah.
Other dogs are fine. They love it. You know, they don't care.
That's right. It's just it's a coping kind of a thing. And I without getting tangled up in my headset cord like I just did. No, I just wanted to say, while I had the chance, that you're surviving. You're being here. You're being the kind of. Expressive person with so many different tastes that echo my own.
Mm-hmm.
You've been very influential in my own transition.
Oh.
Is that like, oh, I know a trans person. They're pretty cool. Oh, I'm a trans person. I hope I'm as cool as Mac. You know, that
you
kind
are.
Of thing like that. No, you're a really good example of that. And I hope that through these interviews that we've already had and future ones that we may have, that you and, you know, whoever other people we'd like to we want you to continue to inspire current and future generations of the LGBT community.
Yeah. I was lucky. I mean, I had Judy for support, and I was when I first started transitioning, I was still handling dogs.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was still handling dogs, going to dog
still handling
shows.
Dogs.
And the main difference about the only. Difference I did was start wearing a suit and tie.
Oh.
And the judges just called me sir. And they'd known me for years.
You did mention specifically that being on testosterone, the way it affected your voice gave you a lot more flexibility in terms of puppet voices.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was like all of a sudden my voice started dropping. And I was like, cool. Because, you know, it's always hard for women to do the male villain voices well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's much easier for a male to do the high little squeaky voices. You know, they just pop up into the falsetto and go. But larynx-wise and all of that stuff, it's harder for females to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can usually tell right away that it's a woman trying to be a man's voice. It's just a timbre thing. I was teaching dog obedience at a local PetSmart during this whole transition period, and I was standing there, and all of a sudden my voice would crack. It was so weird when I'd started testosterone. So I kind of went through what guys do as teenagers. You know, it's like I never knew what would come out of my mouth when I opened it.
Yeah, that was pretty terrible. They bumped me from soprano to alto in public school music at like the third grade. My voice hadn't cracked. It was like, I can't sing the melody anymore. So I had the trauma before my voice changed.
Yeah.
So I was, by the time my voice changed, it's like, oh, this thing again. Yeah.
Whoopee. It is. It didn't last very long. And you know, it just kept going down. And then it stopped going down, which was fine.
And shaving was a bigger trauma for me.
What?
Shaving.
Oh.
I hated having to start to shave. I hated shaving my whole life.
Oh, I always wanted to shave.
I know. There's so many things.
My father was so hairy. I'm like, why can't I have hair like that?
There's so many things. I've thought about, I could have just given stuff to you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, here, you can have my
have an exchange.
Yeah, exactly.
Exchange afternoon. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool?
It would have been wonderful if it would have been that simple.
When Judy and I first came out, we were living as lesbians in Virginia, and we were going to D.C., the D.C. area. Wasn't there a clothes closet in D.C. where people who were going to women could get people would exchange clothes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, clothing exchanges.
Yeah,
absolutely.
A clothing exchange, which I thought was a great idea. You know,
It'd be nice if the body parts and everything else would work that way.
Well, yeah, they're not quite. takes a little bit more to change all that
in terms of this.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, but it all keeps moving, and in spite of a lot of the way the politics have shifted in the last 10 or 15 years,
yeah.
I mean, again, as we've talked about, I remember with us being in North Carolina and North Carolina being sort of the ignition point with the bathroom bill from 2016,
mm-hmm.
And my helping you negotiate that when we'd go off to, you know,
mm-hmm.
I may have mentioned this before, but before I transitioned, Mac and I would go to the movies together a lot because we would want to see movies that our wives did not have any interest in.
Yeah, we like the horror movies.
Yeah, it was just
monster movies.
My wife would go with you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but the science fiction, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That, but yeah, but I was Mac's bathroom buddy, and now Judy is my bathroom buddy. So it's just, you know, that sort of a thing. But it's just again, I think your ability to survive, to maintain your ability to express what's in your heart, what's in your soul, you know, your love for your partner, you know, all that sort of stuff, that is, I think, one of the strongest things about you, about anybody, to be able to do that and do it as well as you do. Because, I mean, if I had been thinking, I would have said, bring a clip of your music in. If we modify the show for a future rebroadcast or anything, I think we should include a clip of his music in the recording, which we can do. So,
And I still have my question about the musical journey, so I think we might have another show. We'll just stress again.
I would talk.
I'm thinking all four of us have a music journey of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
So we could have that be a theme of one of our shows. I think that's a great idea.
That is really good because I specifically, as I alluded to, I got into music because it kept me away from boy activities. And it just opened up a whole new thing.
No PE.
Like I talking with Mac just about that. It's just like, oh yeah, I remember. I used to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're all musicians. Everyone in this room is a musician. That's an excellent idea, Judy. You should tell somebody about that so we do that.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That sounds like a good Zoom thing to have in the we're getting close to the having to close out. I'm just wondering if there's any final things y'all wanna say.
I have something I would like to share about Mac, and this is something that Mac has taught me and that I have observed before and after transition, and it's just gotten deeper and more fulfilling for me to be around him and see how Mac supports everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
He has a way of connecting with people and having them feel great about being themselves. And it just is inspiring. I have to say that. Because he's mine.
And I think,
because the one last thing I was going to ask is, which of all of these things that you have done over the years, what would you say is the thing that makes you most proud? The thing that you're most glad that you did, are doing, will do?
That's a biggie.
Is it Aloysius? Is it the dog relationship? Is it
marrying Judy?
Okay.
I never ever thought I would be married. You know, growing up, I thought no. I was always a loner, so I thought I'll never. And before transition, I'd had a number of girlfriends, but they didn't stick. Let's just put it that way. And then Judy did. So it's amazing to me to wake up and say, God, we've been together 40 years. You know,
mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
And there's nothing, I don't relationship evolution is such a creative act. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's
what we've done. Yeah. She's gone through stuff, and we kind of zing that way, and mm-hmm. I go through stuff all the time. You know, I don't know how she stood it, but we kind of roll with the punches. But I think, you have to decide this is it, and we're going to have it work. So that's one thing I surprised myself mm-hmm. with. And I'm glad I had the support I had transitioning.
Okay. So there.
We're going to go.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Rob and Betty and Mac. Mm-hmm. It's been a wonderful show. I want to also thank WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro at 103.5 FM and the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge possible. Thank you, listeners, for your support and for sharing our stories beyond Orange County. Archived shows are posted at orangecountync.gov/OOTE. Contact us at outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, let's start this week with a note about aging from David Bowie. Aging is an extraordinary process whereby you become the person that you always should have been.
jetpack, the first thing that I do is fly above the gridlock and come to you. I peek into the windows on Fifth Avenue to see how the other side lives. And if I had a jetpack, I would strap it on. I'd get out of this one room and I'd be gone to where there's real houses and big front lawns. If I had a jetpack, I'd take you up with me. At last we'd both be free past the Statue of Liberty in my jetpack. If I had a jetpack, I'd fly above the bridge. I'd wave to all my friends who thought I'd never rise again. I'd fly above the stadium to watch my team win. Watch my team. If I had a jetpack, I'd bust into your door. I'd take you by the hand to the Jersey shore. And underneath the moonlight, you'd want me even more. 'Cause I'd have a jetpack. I'd take you up so high. If I dropped you, you would die. But I want you my side in my jetpack. Oh, I don't have a jetpack. I don't even have a car. I just have this token in a head full of stars. I wish you didn't live uptown so far. 'Cause I don't have, no, don't have a
aren't you, boy, with your quiet voice and impeccable style? Don't ever let them steal your joy and your gentle ways to keep them from running wild. They can kick dirt in your face, dress you down and tell you that your place is in the middle, when they hate the way you shine. I see you tugging on your shirt, trying to hide inside of it and hide how much it hurts. Let them laugh while they can. Let them spin. Discouraged, don't you, girl? It's your brother's world for a while longer. You gotta dance with the devil on a river to beat the stream. Call it living the dream. Call it kicking the ladder. They come to kick dirt in your face, to call you weak and then displace you after carrying your baby on your back across the desert. don't look scared.